Boker Tov, everybody. Welcome to the second week of our summer series and the first of Rabbi Mintz's three-part series on snapshot in American history. He's the third series, so to speak, that Rabbi Mintz is giving, and it's a pleasure to have him back. He, of course, is the rabbi of Kilat Reim Ahuvim in Manhattan, and he did his PhD on American Jewish history. And that's his expertise field among other fields, and he did his PhD actually in Erevin in North America, and it's a pleasure. He's the director of 929 in North America, and of course, I guess we can say we are classmates going back to our days in Yeshiva.
We won't say when.
Okay, thank you very much. Bakashah, Rabbi Mintz.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. Welcome, everybody. Shavua Tov to everybody. It's nice to see you. I start the next three Sunday mornings, snapshots in American Jewish history. Three very different events, but hopefully to get a feel of what the 20th century was like in American Jewish history. The first thing I want to talk about today is the first Heter Aguna in America. The question of the Aguna and the question of how to resolve the plight of the Aguna, of the woman whose husband refuses to give her a get, is an issue that has not been resolved to this very day. We'll talk about that a little bit at the end. But this is not a new issue. And it's not a new issue in America. You see, in the first part of the 20th century, in many ways, this was a really rampant problem. Think about it. Men, generally, would come from Eastern Europe, often without their families to begin with, because they had to see whether they could make a living. And they came to America, and sometimes they would just leave their family. They would find someone else here, or they wouldn't be able to make a living. And their families would be left, and their wives would be left without a get back in Eastern Europe. Now, that was a serious problem, but that's not what I'm talking about here, because in that case, the American rabbi would not be dealing with it. In that case, the Eastern European rabbi would have to deal with it. But because there was no real rabbinic authority here in the United States in the first part of the 20th century, and because these men often would travel from place to place and was often hard to find them, obviously there was no communication or very little communication. So what would happen was someone would come to New York and they would come with their family, and then they would travel around, spend 6 months traveling around looking for a place to have a job, and they would come back. Or they would not come back. And sometimes they would not come back and their wife would be left without a get. And we know that this was a problem because in 1922, the Agudas HaRabbanim, which was the major Orthodox rabbinic organization at the time, sent a letter to all of their rabbis in which they offer assistance in trying to resolve the Aguna issue. Now, I don't know if they did resolve the Aguna issues. They probably didn't resolve them. But the very fact that they sent that letter shows that this was a crisis at the moment. We actually have tshuvot written from this early period that reflect this issue. There was someone by the name of Rabbi Shaul Yedidya Shochet, who was a rabbi in the Midwest, and he wrote several volumes of tshuvot, basically trying to help these women who could not get it. Now, this question became a central piece of the Orthodox rabbinate and the Orthodox community in the 1930s and 1940s. And for this, we need a little bit of biographical background. And here I want to look first at Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. That name, Henkin, is a well-known name. It's a well-known name now. Rabbi Nichan Henkin is the founder of Nishmat, her husband. Rabbi Yehuda Henkin is a famous posek in Yerushalayim. But the family began, at least as far as the American Orthodox community, with a Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. He's born in 1881. His story is not unfamiliar to us. He's born in 1881 in White Russia. Actually, and again, it's tragic, but it relates, you know, to us. His wife dies in the late 19 teens of a magefa, of a plague that took place in Eastern Europe. That probably is what led Rabbi Henkin and his children to immigrate here to the United States. He moves here to the United States, a rabbi, you know, a great Talmud Chacham, but it didn't really make any difference. He needed a job. A job is a job. He became the rabbi of a shtiebel on the Lower East Side. And then literally by chance, and I mean by chance, the story that the family tells is that there was a meeting of Ezra's Torah. Ezra's Torah was the organization that collected money to support Torah institutions in Eastern Europe and in the United States, and then eventually in Israel. He literally walked into a meeting of Ezra's Torah where they were looking for somebody who would become the executive director, the head of Ezra's Torah. He walked into the meeting and said, okay, you're it. And he spent the next 40 years as the head of Ezra's Torah. Just to give you a sense of what he did for Ezra's Torah, he raised over $6 million for Ezra's Torah. $6 million between the years of 1925 and 1960 is a lot of money and was really a lot of money back in those days. But in addition, Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin was the posek, was the rabbinic authority of the Orthodox Jews in the United States, especially in New York, in Manhattan. He was the Rav, he was the rabbi of the Lower East Side, where most of the Jews lived. If you had a question, you went to Rabbi Henkin. And that's correct. He refused to take a penny. I was going to get to that. He refused to take a penny for anything that he did. People went to him and asked him questions. Just to give you a sense of the importance of Rabbi Henkin, Rav Moshe Feinstein, who was 14 years younger than Rabbi Henkin, actually came to the United States in 1936. And he was a neighbor of Rabbi Henkin, and he was the Rosh Yeshiva in Masifta Tiferes Yerushalayim. But to give you a sense of Rabbi Feinstein's influence as a posek, as a rabbinic decisor, the first volume of Igros Moshe, of Rav Moshe Feinstein's Tshuvos, was actually not published until the year 1959. Rabbi Henkin was 80 years old by the time the first volume of Igros Moshe was published. So there were literally almost, there were literally, you know, 40 years, 35 years in which Rabbi Henkin was the posek before Rav Moshe Feinstein. Yes, Rabbi Louis, Professor Louis Henkin was Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin's son. That is correct. Now, Rabbi Henkin began his career as a rabbinic decisor almost immediately when he came to this country. He published his first book, which actually was a book on Gittin and Kiddushin, on marriage and divorce, in 1925, some 4 years after he came to this country. His material has been collected in two volumes. I know you see it backwards, but it says Kisvei Hagon Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin Krak Rishon. There's a second volume as well. I'll refer back to it in a little while. And Rabbi Henkin, in this volume that he published in 1925, takes a position on a topic that became a very controversial topic and an extremely important topic. And that is the question whether a couple that gets married through a civil ceremony requires a get. Meaning, a husband and wife go here in New York, you go to Center Street, you go to the Civil Bureau of Marriage, and you get a civil marriage. And then that couple wants to get divorced. The question is, does that couple need a get? And Rabbi Henkin said, yes, that couple needs a get. There was no rabbi. There were no witnesses. Doesn't matter. They're living together. They consider themselves married. Everybody considers them married. The United States considers them married, and therefore they're married. And therefore, if they want to get divorced, they need a get. What was Rabbi Henkin's proof? So Rabbi Henkin brings a proof from an unbelievable source. The source is a tshuva of somebody called the Rivash. Who is the Rivash? The Rivash is Rabbi Isaac ben Sheshet Perfet. The Rivash was the community rabbi in Algeria at the beginning of the 15th century, the beginning of the 1400s. He actually had to flee Spain following the anti-Jewish riots in 1391. There are some who believe that the Rivash himself actually lived as a Marano, as a converso, as a secret Jew before he escaped. And he tells the following amazing story. And I'll read this very slowly in English. Sheila, Ishachat Ba'a mi Mallorca. He's talking, he's writing in Algeria, and he says, a woman comes to me from Mallorca in Spain. Meotan ha'anusot lavodat kochavim. From those who were forced to convert to Christianity. Ubinna b'cheika, and her son is with her. V'nomar la v'mativech umativa shel benze. Meaning, and I asked, you know, what is the status of you? What is your status and what's the status of your son? Is what I asked her. The Amran, she told me the following story. Shanus echan me'eret Aragon, tav'a lihinaselo kodem hagzera kidat Moshev Yisrael, v'lo al tabiado. She wanted to be married to somebody before 1391, Kedas Moshe of Yisrael, according to the rules of the Jewish people. Below Al Tabiado, it didn't happen. They weren't able to get married in time. Ulachar Agzera, and after 1391, Bikamo Shavu Echad, like very quickly afterwards, Ba'anus Echad Lavodat Kochavim Ohavo Shaloto Anus, a friend of the person who I was supposed to get married to, Hachafetzba, who wanted to marry her. Vidiber Aliba, he spoke sweetly to her. Lihina Seya love, and he convinced her to marry him. Vihinit Paisa. Vinigmar Hazivug Beinehem, and they got married. Ella Shalokidsha Be'idim Vlo Nasolo Basara. But of course, they didn't get married with a minion. They didn't have a rabbi. A priest married them. Ella Al Yide Ovde Kochavim Bechukas. Bechukos datam, uvekohane bamotam. She got married through a priest. V'yashva bebeito, when she lived in his house, imoki sholachol davar. She was his wife. Becheskat ishut. V'hayu yodim zehanusim rabim. V'yashavi makimishlosh kimishalosh chadashim. And she lived with him for 3 months. V'nitabra mimenu. She became pregnant. V'zepirya, and this boy is her son. V'halacha ishahu me'ever layam, and then this guy disappears. V'lo yasav shuve leha od, and he disappeared. Yilamdenu rabenu mayia mishpata v'imyesh lachush la imla. So now, this woman wants to get remarried. Wow, what an amazing case! She was amazing in a tragic sense, but amazing. This woman gets married to somebody who is a convert to Christianity. She's a former Jew, he's a former Jew. They get married by a priest. He disappears. She makes her way to Algeria, and she wants to marry a Jew. The question is, she was married to this guy who used to be Jewish. Yisrael af al pi shechata Yisrael hu. Once a Jew, always a Jew. The question is, she can't get a get from this guy. He disappeared. He was not Jewish anymore. Can she remarry or can she not remarry? That was the question that was asked of the Rivash. And the answer that the Rivash gives, and of course, like all rabbinic answers, the answer is a long, complicated answer. But the Rivash's answer is that no, she does not need a get. Since she was married by a priest, she does not need a get. That's it. She does not need a get. Says Rabbi Henkin, you see from that case that it was only in the case where they were married by a priest that they don't need a get. But in a case where they're married by civil authorities, of course she needs a get. And she can't remarry without a get. That is what Rabbi Henkin writes. And therefore, the civil ceremony requires her to have a get. She cannot remarry without a get. Who disagrees with that? Many years later, 30 years later, 35 years later, actually, Ramosha Feinstein in a tshuva dated 1959 says that a civil ceremony does not require a get. And not surprisingly, what is the source of Moshe Feinstein? That very same responsum of the Rivash. He says, you see, the Rivash says that when they get married by a priest, they don't need a get. And the same thing, if you get married by the civil authorities, you do not need a get. So the disagreement between Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Henkin, whether or not a civil ceremony requires a get or does not require a get, is actually both based on the same tshuva. And the question is the tshuva of the Rivash a precedent for the fact that in that situation you don't need a get, and therefore in a civil situation you don't need a get? Or if Henkin says, no, that situation was unique, but in a civil situation, you would require a get. Now, you understand that this is a huge, huge issue because, you know, in those days, not everybody got married, the chuppah of a kiddushin. Not everybody got married through a rabbi. So somebody who's living together, a man and woman who are living together, who haven't been married by a rabbi, but rather either they're just living together or they were married through a civil ceremony, and then the husband disappears, does the woman need a get? According to Moshe Feinstein, she doesn't need a get. She can get remarried. But according to Rabbi Henkin, she does need a get. So you see, according to Moshe Feinstein, many agunos are resolved because they didn't get married through a rabbi. According to Rabbi Henkin, that does not give permission for her to be remarried. Now, a related question in order to understand this issue is a question of a reform wedding. What about a couple who gets married in a reform ceremony? Interestingly, neither Rav Moshe nor Rav Henkin talk about a conservative ceremony. So we'll talk about what they talk about. Rav Moshe Feinstein says that if a couple gets married and the rabbi is a reform rabbi, there is no need for a get. Not only is there no need for a get, he says actually getting married through a reform ceremony has less status than getting married through a civil ceremony. He says because when you get married through a civil ceremony, everyone knows it's not religious. It is what it is, and there's no need for a get. Says the problem when you get married by a reform rabbi, it might be you think that you're actually married because you think that the rabbi is a rabbi. So he says, no, it needs to be said clearly that if you get married through a reform rabbi, you do not need a get. Happens to be that our friend, Rabbi Henkin, disagrees on that as well. Says Rabbi Henkin, actually, here I have something from 1964, but he said it many years earlier as well. And the wonder of wonders which makes one's hair stand on edge is that you are lenient regarding a marriage performed by a reform rabbi. Is there really a need for an officiating rabbi? If a Jewish man says to a Jewish woman, you are mine, in front of witnesses, then she becomes his wife. And if there are no witnesses at the ceremony, the fact that they live together as a married couple for many years is considered acceptable testimony. What difference does it make if the witnesses were reform? Now, wow, what difference does it make if the witnesses were reform? So here again, you have a double issue. Rabbi Henkin really follows his way of thinking. And that is, he says, I don't care if a couple gets married through a civil ceremony or through a reform rabbi. The bottom line is, if they live together as husband and wife, they need a get. Rav Moshe Feinstein, number one, says a civil ceremony requires them to give a get, to have a get. And then Rav Moshe Feinstein feels even stronger in the sense that he doesn't like reform. He doesn't generally, this is not the topic here today, though it's a fascinating topic. Rav Moshe Feinstein does not like Reform Judaism. He felt that Reform Judaism was undermining Orthodox Judaism. Rav Henkin doesn't seem to be concerned very much about Reform Judaism. Rabbi Feinstein is very much concerned about Reform Judaism. So Rav Moshe Feinstein says, not only is it as bad as a civil ceremony, the question is, that maybe it's even worse than a civil ceremony. So here you go. Here you go. Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rabbi Henkin. Rav Moshe Feinstein says that a civil ceremony doesn't need a get. That doesn't resolve every aguna, but it does resolve some of the agunas. 30 years earlier, Rabbi Henkin really literally kind of corners himself, because the problem of aguna, of husbands not giving get into their wives, was a problem in early Orthodoxy in America. Yet, Rabbi Henkin, rather than making it easier for himself by kind of disallowing civil ceremonies or disallowing reform marriages, actually, he says that no. Each of those cases are considered marriages. So if a couple gets married in a civil ceremony and he won't give a get, then she's stuck. She's an aguna. If they get married through a reform rabbi and they live together and he won't give a get, then she's stuck. She's an aguna. So what are you going to do? How are you going to solve this problem? So here, let me just take 1 second because I'm getting a couple of chats and I'm not following them. It's quite possible that the rabbis at the time didn't use ksuva. I know of such a case. That's interesting. A ksuva would not disallow the wedding. A man and woman are not allowed to live together without a ksuva, but they're married even without a ksuva. Even Rav Moshe Feinstein preferred a get, but he was mekel. That is correct. Rav Moshe Feinstein did say if you could get a get, that that's preferable. But Rav Moshe Feinstein allowed, if you couldn't get a get, that he didn't consider her to be an aguna. Since Rabbi Kelman, we're talking here about a case of aguna, we're talking about a case basically of where it was impossible to get a get in such a situation. So what do we do? Back to our sources. Rabbi Henkin writes as follows. Rabbi Henkin writes, 1928. In the past few years, the problem of the aguna has increased in Europe and here in America. This is a question that burns in the entire world as to what we can do for our sisters to save them from the chains of aguna when their husbands disappear. For this reason, there have been leniencies suggested here, the termination of civil marriages without a get. However, since we have proven that these leniencies have no basis in halacha, these leniencies are really stringencies to destroy lives, and such should not be done in Israel. Now, that raises a very interesting question. What Rav Henkin points out is that if a woman needs a get to remarry and doesn't get a get before she remarries, her children are mamzerim, her children are illegitimate children. So this is not a thing like it's nice to get a get, but if you can't get a get, it's not such a big deal. Rav Henkin is pointing out we're dealing here with a very serious issue. So Rav Henkin, here we have Rav Henkin in 1928. Rav Henkin realizes the seriousness of the issue. Rav Henkin doesn't like the solutions, whether it's the solutions to say that a civil ceremony is not a ceremony, whether it's all the other solutions that have been suggested. He doesn't like those solutions. The question is, what is Rav Henkin going to do? How is he going to solve this problem? So in that very same tshuva of 1928, Rav Henkin makes the following suggestion. Rav Henkin suggests that at the wedding, at every wedding, the husband authorize the court that a get can be written at a later date if certain things happen, like he is not able to write the get on his own, or if he refuses to give a get. Then Rav Henkin says, if you have a situation where the husband refuses to give a get, since he has authorized the court to give a get. The woman would go to a central court. At least at the beginning, Rav Henkin thought that central court would be in Jerusalem. He very quickly gave up on that idea. But the woman would go to the court. Since the husband has authorized the writing of the get at the time of the wedding, the get can be written later, even though he opposes the writing of the get later, and she would be free. She would be allowed to be remarried. Now, that is super interesting. You see, we need just to give a 1 second background. And that is that we know that the Torah says that a man needs to divorce his wife of his own volition. He needs to do it willingly. Therefore, we can't force the husband to write again. But here, Rav Henkin has an amazing chap. Rav Henkin says that the husband will authorize the get. Now, the husband authorizes the get at the time of the wedding when he never thinks that he's going to need a get. But then if she needs a get at some later point, she's protected because he has authorized a get. Rav Henkin suggests that this suggestion be brought before the other rabbis and they decide whether or not this is an acceptable suggestion. This is a very interesting suggestion, by the way, because it works very much within the kind of rubric of halacha, and it's being suggested by the Posek Hadar, by the Posek of the Lower East Side, Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin. But as always, these stories are more complicated for reasons that don't always relate directly to the topic. What happened was that in 1930, right after Rav Henkin made this suggestion, there was a Rabbi Louis Epstein. Rabbi Louis Epstein was a leading conservative rabbi from Boston and the president of the Rabbinical Assembly and its Committee on Jewish Law. And Rabbi Epstein comes up with the following suggestion. Prior to every marriage, the husband should appoint his wife as an agent to execute a divorce on his behalf. Here you have another chop, not to authorize the court, but that he actually authorizes his wife. So if later on he doesn't want to give his wife a get, she could actually divorce herself because he's authorized her to write a get for herself. And he writes this, and he actually writes an entire volume called Hatza'ah Leman Takanat Agunot. And he sends this book around to hundreds of rabbis asking for their opinions. The amazing thing is that one of the rabbis he sends this around to is Rabbi Henkin. And Rabbi Henkin makes a few comments, but there's nothing in Rabbi Henkin's comment that makes it seem as if Rabbi Henkin doesn't think that this is a very good idea. The problem is, and again, you're not surprised, that the Orthodox rabbis have a fit. They do not approve of this suggestion. Mostly they don't approve of this suggestion because it's suggested by a conservative rabbi. And therefore, the Orthodox rabbis, you know, in those days, obviously, there's no email. There's no way of communication. The only way you're able to communicate is if you write a book. So the Agudas HaRabbanim writes a book in 1937. It's called Lidor Acharon. Lidor Acharon means that it was written for future generations, and it's basically an entire book that attacks the suggestion of Rabbi Epstein. And believe it or not, in this book, there is a letter from our friend Rabbi Henkin. And Rabbi Henkin in this book writes the following. And I have already written that the reason that I have become involved in this battle is due to the fact that Rabbi Epstein mentioned my proposal for the freeing of Agunot. And I must escape from this comparison. My proposal was merely a suggestion and not meant as a halachic decision. And when the volume Ein Tnai B'Nisuin was published, I retracted from my position, for even the greatest scholar has to follow the majority view. So basically, we have a few things in this little paragraph. Number one is we see that Rabbi Henkin pulls back from his original suggestion. His 1928 suggestion, his great idea to authorize a court to write a get in the future, he says was only a suggestion. But he puts another variable in here. He says, and when the volume Ein Tnai B'Nisuin was published, I retracted from my position. What's Ein Tnai B'Nisuin? So in 1930, in Paris, There was a book written by a rabbi. Remember, 1930 Paris is before Hitler. There's a book written by a rabbi called, his name was Rabbi Judah Lubetzky. And Rabbi Lubetzky makes a suggestion at the time. He basically says that any marriage, if a couple was married by civil authorities, then they can get divorced by civil authorities as well. Slightly different than both Rabbi Henkin and Rabbi Epstein, but also a suggestion. If they get married by civil authorities, means you have to undo it, kibolo kakpolto. You have to undo it the way that you got yourself into it. So if you get married through a civil ceremony, you can get unmarried. You can get divorced from a civil ceremony. Yeah, okay, we'll get there in a second. It's a good question. We'll get there in a second. So what happens? What happens is like this. In 1928, Rabbi Henkin, realizing the problem that there are so many agunot in America, and realizing that his halachic position that says that civil ceremonies are considered to be marriages and reform ceremonies are considered to be marriages, so Rabbi Henkin realizes he needs to come up with a solution. And he comes up with a solution, again, a halachic solution, which in a sense is not very controversial. I mean, you could agree or disagree. We're not here to go through all the halachas. But basically, the get has to be written willingly by the husband. The fact that the husband authorizes a court to write a get, that seems to be a pretty good, solid solution. What happens? Unrelated to Rabbi Henkin, what happens is that other people get on the bandwagon. There are other controversial people who make similar suggestions. First, the conservative rabbi, Rabbi Epstein, and then this Rabbi Lubetzky from Paris. Now, when Rabbi Epstein first makes his suggestion, Rabbi Henkin still thinks maybe it's going to be okay. But when he sees that there's another suggestion from Paris, and he sees, and this is an important point, and he sees that the Orthodox rabbinate is against Rabbi Epstein, Rabbi Henkin, and Rabbi Henkin here, this is a very important point, Rabbi Henkin very much is a communal rabbi. Rabbi Kelman asks, you know, how can you follow the majority? You have to, you know, do what's right. Rabbi Henkin is very much a communal rabbi. Rabbi Henkin understands his role as the leading rabbinic authority of the time. And therefore, the minute that a solution to the Agunah problem becomes kind of intertwined in this, in what we would call today rabbinic politics, right? You know, a conservative rabbi, a rabbi in Paris who nobody liked or who didn't, they thought he wasn't, you know, responsible enough. Rabbi Henkin needs to pull back. Rabbi Henkin can't get involved in this because the minute Rabbi Henkin gets involved, so what's the difference between Rabbi Henkin's suggestion and Rabbi Epstein's suggestion? The problem is that Rabbi Henkin is not an Orthodox rabbi. Rabbi Henkin's an Orthodox rabbi and Rabbi Epstein's not an Orthodox rabbi. Yeah, we're going to get there with Rabbi Berkowitz in a second, okay? So Rabbi Henkin pulls back. And I want to show you something which is absolutely unbelievable here. And that is, look here at this page. This page is a page from the reprint of Rabbi Henkin's tshuva on this Aguna issue. If you notice on the side of the page, he has like bracketed off this page and the following page. And he has two words here. Hadru B. I retract. I want to tell you something. In all my years of reading rabbinic literature, I have never, ever, ever seen that in a rabbinic book. He basically had his suggestion. And in a later edition, either he or the editors, you know, it's interesting. They have it there because he wrote it. But they say on the side, you know, he didn't just press the delete button. He says, I retract what I wrote. So, you know, you kind of can live within the different editions of Rabbi Henkin's work. You can live the story because it's there. His suggestion is there. But because of the rabbinic politics, Hadru B, he decided to change his mind. Now, what's interesting is somebody asked the question before. There has been work done on the Aguna question since then. I will say that I saw that Nat Lewin is on this call. Rabbi Kelman, you should know that you should have a class in which Nat will explain the get law and his involvement in the get law and all the controversies that surrounded the get law, which was an extremely fascinating piece of this puzzle. I won't even begin to try to explain the get law with Nat on this call. That's his topic. But I will say, going back to the halakhic material since then, that there is something that's interesting. So again, basically, Rabbi Henkin's suggestion of 1928 fell away. Fell away not because it was halachically problematic, but fell away because of what we're calling rabbinic politics, because what went on around the suggestion. Now, in 1967, there was a volume published by Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz. Rabbi Eliezer Berkowitz was an extremely important Orthodox philosopher, was a student of Rabbi Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, and he wrote a book called Tnai B'Nisuim Uveget. And he tries to address the Aguna issue. Now, what's amazing, again, I don't want to get involved in his argument. I'm only interested in his book for one reason. If you look at his volume, he makes reference to Rabbi Henkin's retracted suggestion of 1928. So what's ironic is that in 1928, Rabbi Henkin makes a suggestion about how to resolve the Aguna issue by him authorizing the court to write again at a later point. He retracts it because of a whole bunch of rabbinic politics that go on in the 1930s in the United States. But and you see it in the volume where it says Hadrubi. But in 1967, obviously many, many decades later, Rabbi Epstein's not a factor, and the rabbi, oh, that's interesting. Thank you so much. And what, you know, where Rabbi Epstein's not an issue and Rabbi Lebetsky's not an issue. He's writing Rabbi Berkowitz about the issue of Aguna and trying to resolve the question of Aguna. And what he realizes is that the suggestion made by Rabbi Henkin in 1928 is a suggestion that needs to be considered and that, you know, needs to be, you know, needs to be considered in the whole bigger picture. Now, we're living here in 2020, and unfortunately, we're still challenged by the Aguna issue. And again, that's a much bigger picture and a much bigger story than this class. Because really what I want to show you is, in this class, not so much a resolution to the Aguna issue, but I want to show you, you know, sometimes you think that the issues that we address today, that we confront today, are new issues. Issues that people didn't think about before, or people didn't argue about before, or people weren't concerned about before. But what I want to show you is that, I didn't know that. That's very interesting. Mayor Simcha Feldblum, thank you very much. I'd love if you sent me a copy of that paper. Thank you so much. Rabbi Mayor Simcha Feldblum, who is a great rabbinic authority and a teacher in YU, so I'd love to see his paper on the topic. So what's important is that the Orthodox rabbinate, as we know that Orthodox rabbinate, really only came into shape in the early part of the 20th century. Rabbi Henkin was arguably the first great American posek. And what you see is that Rabbi Henkin's first tshuva, first voyage into the world of halacha, I'm not talking about the Lieberman Clause. By the time the Lieberman Clause was introduced in the 50s, it was already conservative and was not even considered by the Orthodox. Professor Mark Shapiro, who's a big who's number one in Torah Motion, make sure to listen to all of Mark Shapiro's stuff. So Mark Shapiro wrote a fascinating little volume on Saul Lieberman and the Orthodox. In that volume, there is a correspondence between Saul Lieberman, Professor Saul Lieberman, and Rabbi Soloveitchik about the Lieberman Clause. That is an interesting story, and Rabbi Kelman, I'm sure you can have him come in and tell that story. But for our purposes, you see, what's interesting is in 1930, when Rabbi Epstein makes his suggestion, so he writes to Rabbi Henkin and they try to work it out between the two of them. By the 1950s, Saul Lieberman is conservative. The Orthodox are not going to accept that. But what you see is that this issue is an issue from the very beginning. This is the first thing that Rabbi Henkin deals with. And that even, and that rabbinic politics, we think rabbinic politics today, but rabbinic politics were very much a part of the of the playing field then as well. And the minute that a suggestion is made, a similar suggestion is made by the conservative rabbi, that forces Rabbi Henkin to say Hadrubi, that he has to retract his opinion. But that 30 years later, in Rabbi Berkowitz's volume, that issue is revisited, that suggestion is revisited. And I think what you really see is, you talk about standing on the shoulders of giants. This past week, Rabbi Lamb, obviously, I'm sure Rabbi Kelman will have much to say about Rabbi Lamb. But, you know, one of the things that was said about Rabbi Lamb is that today we live on the shoulders, modern Orthodoxy lives on the shoulders of Rabbi Lamb. Leave that aside, that requires a whole analysis. But there's no question that we live on the shoulders of Rabbi Henkin and the greats of the early 20th century, the early rabbinic greats and the early communal greats of the early 20th century. And I think that while today we have still not resolved, unfortunately, the plight of the Agunah, but I think, and hopefully what I've told the story this morning, is that we're on the shoulders of those giants as we address the topic, and we appreciate the courage that they had to address these topics in earlier, much more difficult times. Now, before I send everybody away, let's just take a second to see what is being used today by hundreds of couples, Rabbi Michael Broich's tripartite agreement. I'm aware of that. That's also an interesting discussion. You can have Rabbi Broich come and talk about a tripartite agreement. That's also an interesting thing. And the question about the prenuptial agreement and how that works. Again, this is another topic. How to address the Agunah issue today is obviously an extremely important topic. That wasn't what I wanted to talk about. What I wanted to talk about was the early addressing of this issue. Next week, another snapshot, the founding of the Maimonides School in Boston. It's not the first of the Jewish day schools, but it's one of the first. And the issues of Maimonides School and Rabbi Soloveitchik's involvement are absolutely fascinating. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman. Have a wonderful week, everybody. Stay safe. Hope that we have good news for everybody. I look forward to seeing you next Sunday.
Rabbi, can I make a comment? Thank you.
You sure can.
No, I mean, I know you've been talking about it. That's sort of your whole talk, but maybe you just want to flesh out a little bit sort of the, I guess I'll call it a tragedy that, and Jacob Katz deals with it, you know, years ago, the fact that the reform of the conservative movement, though, had there not been a reform or a conservative movement, the Orthodox movement would have solved the Aguna problem long ago. And I just, if you want to comment on that, would you sort of indirectly?
Yeah, I mean, there's no question that that's right. I mean, that is one Rabbi Kelman takeaway from this story. And that is that ultimately the reason that Rabbi Henkin pulled back was because of Rabbi Epstein. Once the Orthodox came out against Rabbi Epstein, so that was the end. The other point is, of course, the other point, of course, is that the Lieberman Clause within the Ksuva probably would have taken had he not been connected with JTS. So those are two moments, Rabbi Kelman, where the Agunah problem could have been addressed. But because they were identified with the conservative movement, that was, you know, that they didn't have a chance. Now, I just missed one comment here. One second. I don't know anything about Toronto. Rabbi Kelman is the expert. My grandfather, Rabbi Yolis, was a Rav in Philadelphia, and I saw a package of 100 postcards from Heter Meir Rabbanim. He did the 30s and 40s. Heter Meir Rabbanim, something else, and with this I'll end. Heter Meir Rabbanim says, polygamy is not allowed. Polygamy is not allowed by based on the Cheirem of Rabbeinu Gershom in the year 1000. But the Cheirem of Rabbeinu Gershom can be undone by a Heter Meir Rabbanim. So there are those who allow a husband to remarry if he can't give a get based on a Heter Meir Rabbanim. That's what you wrote, what Rachel wrote here about the tripartite agreement is not a prenuptial, that's correct. It's purely halachic agreement, which can be used in Canada, type of Tanai B'Kiddushin. So Rachel Levmore is, again, I'm humbled to talk in front of people who are real experts on this topic. Again, my expertise is limited to American Jewish history. Rachel Levmore is the expert. And thank you for your leadership on this topic. And she can explain the tripartite agreement. That's correct. The tripartite agreement is not a prenup. Because I wrote my doctorate, Igunesh, comparing New York and Toronto. Okay, fine. Again, I don't claim to know. I claim to know very little about New York and zero about Toronto. I pass it back to Rabbi Kelman. Have a great Sunday, everybody. Stay safe. Shavua Tov. See you next Sunday. Be well. Thank you, Rabbi Kelman.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody. Tomorrow morning, 11, I have a lot to say on Toronto, but I won't say it now. Toronto is a wonderful place. 11 a.m. tomorrow morning, Rabbi Liebtag on the beginning of a series on contradiction, teaching Sefer Bamidbar and Sefer Dvarim. And Tuesday, everybody's welcome. And on Tuesday morning, Marty Lakshman will be starting his series on Tamei HaMitzvot and continuing with Nechama Price, Naomi Seidman, myself. Parsha Teshuvah this week is Rabbi Torchiner, the head of the Kollel here in Toronto. And we invite you all. We look forward to learning with you and seeing with you, hearing your ideas. And correct